Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills and today I'm joined by Sam Williams.
I am tired today.
I didn't ask you how you were. I'm Bruce Fitzpatrick.
Hello. Very punchy opening there, Thomas.
Well, I'm probably the most energetic of all of us at the moment. You guys look a bit drained.
There was a real crack to the way that you said back there. But yeah, I think we're all suffering with some post-mixer come down blues, really, aren't we?
I never thought that was going to be a thing, if I'm honest. I think you get it on like a week-long holiday, don't you? Or, you know, a really good stag do, you get that. But you just don't expect it from one golf day at your own golf club. And my God, I've got the blues.
And the WhatsApp groups are popping up all over the show. Everyone seems to be creating new groups, making new friends. So the mixer, we need to, for those uninitiated, we need to fill them in. Sam, this was your baby.
The mixer was my baby. That was how it was positioned. So that they say that success has many fathers. Now, you've got to remember, I pitched you this idea back in January and said, I think it'd be really cool if we had a cool golf day, got loads of really good people along, let them invite some people, and just have a bit of a party, get some live music. And I remember seeing Bruce sort of like cringe when I suggested the concept of live music and barbecuing food out on the first tee. But actually, we struck gold with the weather. The day went off really pretty much without a hitch, didn't it? If we're being honest. And I must say, the cast of people that were there was absolutely superb. I've never been in an environment like that where everyone was literally buzzing for about 15 hours straight. It was absolutely remarkable.
It was exceptional, wasn't it?
Exceptional.
I've never been so happy to not hit a golf ball with the standard of golf that was going on around me. I would have been completely out of my depth to be stood on that tee. There were some ball strikers knocking about. It was a very,
that applies
very
most of the
day.
Time, though, to be fair, Tom. We're off up to Scotland on Sunday. The same could be said then.
Could be said. Did you ever, you were subbed in, Bruce? Did you?
I was, yeah.
Have a good knock?
Oh, it was great fun. No, it was, as you were saying there, Mills, it was really enjoyable actually just being sat on the front desk, just kind of welcoming people, getting to put sort of faces to Instagram handles or Twitter handles or whatever you want to call them and meet these people and get everyone together. And obviously the weather was great. The course was in fantastic shape from the club championship the day before. And then, I mean, yeah, it was great to end up partnering up with John Davey from Sound of Golf and then playing with Nick, who is actually incidentally one of our official unofficial sponsors of the podcast, isn't he? So, Saunders and Long, nice little plug there. And then Sam Scouten from Fescue and June. So it was like, yeah, I mean, it was brilliant.
Just talking about the event, it was, I think, Andy, so shout out to Heath and Blog who won, and Andy's kind of been a big supporter of the jar for some time and seems to know pretty much everyone in UK golf. And seeing him win, he gave a little acceptance speech and just said how cool it was. Just seeing all these people who've been interacting online in like quite a cool little community, and you know, you realize how small it is when everyone kind of gets together and sort of joins all the dots. And I just thought that was really cool. And, you know, to be brutally honest as well, I mean, we only sent out what, like 35 invites, I think, back in March, and thought, let's see, I fully expected I was going to be on the phone begging people to come to the event come May. It was a really big success, wasn't it? And I mean, I might be jumping the gun ever so slightly, but I think, you know, more events in due course could certainly happen. And we want to kind of include as many people in those as we can. So, you know, if people didn't get to come to the mixer, then, you know, fear not, there's going to be other chances for other events. It was just, I think it was pretty much the most rewarding thing we've been involved in since we started, if I'm being honest.
And there's going to be, like you said, there's going to be more. And I mean, Andy from Heath and Blog one, along with a former podcast guest, incidentally, Michael Verity. So that was really nice to see that they, people that we've interacted with and people we've done stuff with have managed to go on and win the event. And it wasn't about the winning. It really was about the the mixing, which is hence the title. But like you say, I think there is definitely scope for some more. So keep your ears peeled because there will probably be more on the horizon. So, but we shouldn't wax too lyrical about the mixer, because for those who weren't involved, we don't want this to turn into a pastiche.
If you haven't seen the mixer video that's up on YouTube and live, you must go and check it out. There is a brilliant little address in there at the end by James Woods, who pulled out some verse from the 1920s from, I think, Muirfield to St. George's, and kind of changed some phraseology and included terms like woke in there. And I just thought that was, it was a very good touch. So
very good indeed.
Job on that video. And I think if people want to check it out, go and have a look at that.
Definitely.
And speaking of film, we've got an interesting segue. We have just released in the last hour our first of the Old Tom Trails film, which is basically a series that we're going to chase around Old Tom and the jobs that he's done and the courses that he's managed, and hopefully at the end put a little bit about him together. And the first one on the agenda was The Name.
Timed very well to coincide with The Amateur, which is obviously ongoing as we speak. We've just gone from round of 64 down to round of 32, I believe. Is that correct?
Match play started today, didn't it?
Yeah. So,
well, I was on the phone to Stuart McCollum from Castle Stewart earlier on today, and he lives obviously in the Nairn and Castle Stewart right next to each other, and he said it is blowing a hoolie, like 40 mile an hour winds, like absolute catastrophic winds. And if you look at the stroke play results, the guy who came the leader on the stroke play to get through shot 72, which is one over, 62.
I saw that
nine
yesterday.
Under to be an 8 under par leader through, and then lost 5 and 4 in the first round of the, a tough old day for Clark. I mean, there's some up and down golf. I mean, some stratospheric golf, but it's up and down. It just shows how difficult it's playing, and the depth of field is obviously obscene.
Still pretty substantial. Yeah. Even without a lot of the internationals not coming over because of restrictions in place. And I think, you know, it's not disrespectful to say, it's just a reflection of the fact that the field is slightly diluted this year. But as you say, even still, the fact that you've got players who are able to shoot 62 and they're going out in the in the round of 64 shows, I guess, partly the kind of randomness you can get with match play events and the excitement, but also just the number of great players out there, and the variable weather conditions as well. I mean, you mentioned there, Mills, day one of qualifying, I think, was very, very difficult. Callum Scott, Sandy Scott's brother, by the sounds of things, played, you know, one of the best rounds ever of his life or of his career, to shoot 3 under and post a lead in those conditions. Then yesterday it was really balmy and scoreable and not much wind at all. And now we're kind of back to some pretty windy conditions today. So it's interesting seeing how the players deal with that. And obviously we experienced it on a similar day back in April when we went and filmed it, which is why we've got the woolly hats and several layers on. And I certainly found it extremely challenging in conditions like that.
Yeah, it's going to be quite tough for Callum Scott, isn't it? You know, Sandy's brother, and he's a home club, and there's a lot of pressure there, isn't it? Hopefully he can manage to pull through. But yeah, I mean, can I imagine playing the Amateur at your home club? I mean, I can't imagine playing the Amateur at all, to be fair, but it would be good at your home club.
I think when you're playing in those kind of conditions as well, you're going to play a medal, you can very easily get on the wrong side of the draw, I'd imagine, because 40 mile an hour wind, you know, if that varies a little bit, you kind of, it's incomparable one side of the draw to next, isn't it? And great tournament though. Really cool. I actually quite, what do you think about the way the R&A do it? They seem to play it out quite a bit through the stories and stuff on social media. I remember the final at Birkdale last year on Twitter, and I just thought it was quite cool. It was almost just basically iPhone footage just constantly plastered up on the story, and it wasn't a bad little way of following the match.
Yeah, they're quite good with their social media presence, yeah. I think, the RNA. Well, certainly when it comes to the Amateur, because obviously it's not covered professionally by Sky or anything like that. So it's good that they managed to keep on top of it, because it is one of the only ways you can keep it live. What do we think of The Nairn while we're at it?
Yeah, as I alluded to there, I think as a golf course, it's a fantastic test, isn't it? It maybe doesn't seem that imposing, but when you get there and you stand on a few of those tee boxes, particularly the ones off the tippy tips, and you're kind of flanked by gorse, and you throw a pretty significant crosswind in there, and all of a sudden it becomes pretty tricky, I think. And just, yeah, really nice, sort of solid, quintessential Scottish members club was the vibe I got. I don't know what you guys thought, but I thought really welcoming, obviously a wonderful archive room, and we've made to feel really, really welcome when we got there. And it's awesome that they've preserved so much of that history all in one space, in one dedicated space.
Yeah, I think the there's nothing like when you play the holes that's like jaw-dropping. I don't think you stand on a tee and just go, oh my god, look at this golf hole. There's some
14th of par three, the downhill, that's
a stunner, isn't it? But a lot of it's pretty level. It's there's no massive dunes, there's no gimmicks, there's not many quirks. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just a very good, honest golf course. It's really good. The views along the bay that you're playing along are absolutely incredible. And I think, you know, you kind of get the feeling that it's just a seriously good Highlands golf club as well. Seeing things like the archive room, and I can't even begin to imagine the effort that goes into building a room like that from scratch. I mean, that's 13 or 14 years in the making. That's truly remarkable. I really like the Nairn. I'd 100% go back. The green sites are brilliant, but you've got to hit it properly off the tee, haven't you?
Yeah, I'd like us to go back on a day that's maybe a little bit more reasonable. Yeah, I mean, let's face it, we did have that northern storm front to deal with, bits of hail, freezing temperatures. I mean, it was -3. It was literally -3 when we teed off, and it was really so windy. Cold. So, I'd love to go back and play it in kind of more normal conditions. But what a golf course.
Is it worth a little nod to Sunday's adventure that's coming up? We've got a very exciting week coming up, haven't we?
We've got a few coming up. I mean, we're heading up to Prestwick on Sunday to obviously old Tom's, where he left St Andrews to go and set up the Open at Prestwick and set up the course at Prestwick. So we're going to go there, and then heading across to North Berwick and up to Cruden Bay. And there's a few little places in between we might stop. And I mean, one thing you can say about all the old Tom, the courses that old Tom was involved with, is they are all absolutely amazing. I mean, you can't really get away from it. They're just jaw-dropping. Interesting, though, that the more that we have done this, I feel, and the more that we have visited these clubs and chatted to the archivists, is that old Tom has obviously done a lot of the groundwork and laid original 9, 10, 18 holes. But they've all, pretty much all to a course, been built upon over time and improved. And there's very little left of the actual blueprint of old Tom.
Mm. I agree. I look at them and be like, well, if say, like, let's say Colt did something in 1920 at a golf club will embark on a massive program of work to bring that back to exactly as it was. Not many, I mean, probably something like Askanish, which I think is very much out there as the exception. Not many places will have old Tom heritage and be able and go back and do restoration. I don't think that's because they don't want to. I think that's fundamentally they don't have the materials there to say what was there and when, because things like wartime were such a big way of kind of actually so good at documenting the lay of the land and what was there, which actually I think enables them to do stuff back to like 1920 and 1910. So yeah, I agree. You go to most of them and, you know, the connection, I think a lot of it's the spirit and the accomplishments across his playing career and the architecture and what he did in from an agronomy standpoint, obviously his legacy with young Tom Morris. I think that's the kind of big thing really, rather than necessarily as an architect, because like you say, even Prestwick, where, you know, really he's as instrumental there and as significant as probably St Andrews arguably. And, yeah, I mean, that's changed around significantly. I mean, there's 18 holes on the same land where there once was 12. So,
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, his legacy at a lot of these clubs, in fact, the majority of the clubs, is not the layout or the routing. As you mentioned, there's a select few holes at certain clubs which maybe have remained fairly close to what old Tom laid out. But, you know, he did so much more than simply design golf courses. And he came at a time when the game as a whole was evolving rapidly. And he, you know, he's this figure who was a club maker. He was a professional. He was, one of the very early kind of greenkeepers and someone who brought, you know, huge innovation to that field. He was a great player as well and a competitor. He was a sort of statesman of the game. And just looking at that wider legacy at all these clubs, yes, there are places like Prestwick where he had a huge kind of formative influence in the very establishment of the club and the Open. But even if you go somewhere like Carnoustie or Nairn, like the film we've just released, which have been substantially altered by people like James Braid, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can diminish old Tom's legacy, because in many ways he was the person that inspired a lot of these people to go on and have the careers that they had. He you know, was arguably kind of the first successful professional to combine, you know, course architecture, designing, laying out courses with playing the game and also club making. So I think in many ways, the story of old Tom is a story of his connection with other individuals, whether it's Charles Blair McDonald or Donald Ross or any of the sort of host of architects that we kind of still thank to this day for the courses they've laid out.
I mean, we're obviously recording this on his 200th anniversary. And to be fair, when we started, the agenda wasn't necessarily to talk about him, but it does seem right. I can't. I mean, you look at the work of people like Roger McStravick, and, you know, when we saw him up at St Andrews, very kindly gave us a copy of Footsteps, which won the Herb Warren Wind Award. And I tidily put that in my bag before you two clapped your eyes on it. So that's probably news to you both.
He took another one as well, actually.
And then Road Wars, I think that's a sequel. You can't really read that until you've read the first one, to be honest, Bruce.
But he gave us this book, and we sort of glanced at it before Sam stashed it in the bag. We said, oh, that's really kind. That's a really nice book. And then we decided to name the series. We'd obviously subliminally taken it in, but for the whole time, we're like, we'll call it In the Footsteps of Old Tom. That's what we'll do. And then we realized we completely ripped off the title of his book.
Old Tom Trails. Never there. I mean, I don't know. There's obviously a raft of social media coverage around Old Tom. There will be this week, really probably for most of the summer, given the bicentennial. It's not a light purchase. I think, you know, it's a fairly significant purchase for a book. It's worth every penny. Like, it's super rich in terms of stories. It's fascinating. It's not just about him. The town of St Andrews, the figures that was around, it's like you say, Bruce, it's kind of, it's more about the legacy, I think, with him necessarily than the end product of his work. Because you realize when you read that there's a lot of people doing very similar stuff around him all the time. But in many ways, he just kind of rises above all of that stuff.
Kind of brings it all together, really, doesn't he? He brings together some huge developments in the game.
Really. It's interesting that if we talk about Nairn, because that is the film that we just released. I mean, when we chatted through with the archivist, it was that, you know, they say we don't know entirely what he did and how he laid it out. But what we do know is the eighth hole is as he laid it out. And you play the eighth and you realize that old Tom, when old Tom was laying out courses, he had no earth movement. He was just, this is where we should put the green. This is where we should put the tee. And the holes that you play that are his design are undoubtedly beautiful and tricky because of the way they utilize the lay of the land and the swales, and they're hard. I mean, and they were obviously designed for Hickory Golf because there's a lot of ways you can run it in, and there's the way that he undulates the land or uses the undulations before the green, before you run it in. And I mean, he undoubtedly was exceptional at what he did, but it's just a shame that we've got so little of it left.
Yeah. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that, you know, we've not restored courses to how old Tom, laid them out. You know, there is such a thing as progress, and I don't think, although as you mentioned there, Sam, a lot of the kind of current trends in course architecture are perhaps quite rightly geared towards restoring Colt, Simpson, McKenzie courses. I think with old Tom, you know, it's fair to say there's a huge number of courses that he laid out which have benefited from other people's work and other people lending their hands to the design. I mean, Muirfield kind of stands out as one which, as a result of Harry Colt's intervention, you've got the two kind of concentric loops, which are very, very different to the way that old Tom would kind of route a course, which is very much out and back, the traditional link style. So, and to be honest, you know, not that I can claim to be able to back this up with any real hardcore evidence, but just
Here we go.
But on the basis of him being an innovator and you know, endorsing things like the gutty ball over the feathery ball. I think he's probably someone who would look at subsequent designs and alterations to the courses that he laid out initially and praise the work that future architects or subsequent architects did and the improvements they made.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
He wasn't rigid and kind of rooted in his beliefs. He wasn't kind of dogmatic. So
yeah, 10 out of 10. I like it.
Yeah, and we're big fans, clearly big fans, and we are in the process of a now 8-week schedule of releasing films that are based around Old Tom and his works. So keep.
Can I just ask as well quickly, in terms of the courses, we've got, I've played Prestwick before. I've not played Cruden Bay or North Berwick. They would feature pretty near the top of my bucket list, I would say. I'm pumped for those two. Tom, you've played none of them?
None.
Bruce, you've done?
I've done North Berwick. I've not done Cruden Bay and I've not done Prestwick, and I'm very excited to do both of those.
Which means my ball rack is going to get plastered with some new logoed balls, which I'm very excited.
Three more logoed balls.
At least three.
You've only been doing it for a few months. And you basically, now, as soon as you go through East Lothian, you're going to spend an entire day driving around professional shops loading up from your last trip.
Yeah, I forgot to get them in East Lothian last time, so I'm just looking at it now with a disappointing lack of Renaissance, Kilspindi, Bjorfield, Gullen. So I'm going to have to go pick those up. Musselburgh, I mean, that's missing as well. I'm not sure if Musselburgh have got a logo ball, but we're going to go find out. Now, that's enough about Old
Progress.
Tom.
Progress, Tory Pines, 400-yard drives.
Here we go.
How's Old Tom going to feel about Tory Pines?
I think he'd think it was big.
The next order of business.
7,800 yards. Tory Pines doesn't protect itself with length. Yeah, it's a mutant. Another mutant.
I mean, look, I don't want to sound like a broken record here, but another load of superlatives being thrown out about this is one of the longest golf courses going. I mean, Kiowa was 7,800 yards. You know, a load more posts on Instagram about people dropping a ball in the rough, saying the rough at Torrey Pines is no joke. You're not going to believe what you see. It's like, I don't know about you guys. I've seen that every year for the past 5 years. I mean, show me a US Open venue where you're not losing a ball when you drop it at shoulder height in the right place. It's just, I don't know. I'm just a bit bored by it. Like, I'm just a bit, because I've seen it every year.
I'm not sure that means it's a bad open, though. So I read quite a good article by Friedegg in the week, who basically said, look, you know, clearly it's not a strategic golf course. It's just slam it. I think Bryson even went in front of the media and said, yeah, I mean, my strategy this week is pretty much going to be bomb it as far as I can. And if I'm off the fairway, I'm just going to gouge it out. I mean, he used the words bomb and gouge, which I thought was brilliant. But it doesn't mean it's going to be
I wasn't saying that. I was just criticizing the content.
No, I know what you mean. The lead up is always, it's always like, oh, watch this. Yeah. Oh my God, it's thick as hell. It's like, yes, we know. Because we've now been on this for years.
But do you not think that it's just an agenda from the players? Because they have managed to get their way before by doing this. You know, there was things a couple of years back of Kevin Na dropping in the rough and taking like 6 shots to try and get out. And then all of a sudden, not because Kevin Na is like suddenly on his own swayed this, but all of a sudden, like the day before the tournament, they've decided to chop the rough back or add an extra cut. And do you not think this is just the players just trying to influence the golf?
No, I don't think so. They don't mind them hard. Some of them don't really care how hard it is. I mean, I just think they have to set it up brutally difficult, don't they? I mean, the US Open is probably, of all the tournaments, the one that tries to protect par more than any other, isn't it? I think, anyway. You know, the objective going in there for someone who's setting it up is they're scared to death if someone wins that at 18 under. They're quite happy for someone to go in and win at 2 under. But the worst thing that could happen that week would be someone, you know, kind of destroying the course. So, I mean, clearly that's not going to happen. I wouldn't have thought at Tory Pines. Patrick Reed won there earlier in the year. I can't remember what the winning score was. It was, from memory, it wasn't mega low. It might have been 12 or something. Well, there you go there. But it will be much tougher, I thought, in the summer.
Yeah, they wouldn't have had US Open rough.
Firmer.
Lusher. Yeah.
Thicker rough.
Plenty of talk about Brooks-Bryson pairing. I think that was maybe slightly overhyped, which clearly is not going to happen.
They're just trying to work on the pip, aren't they?
Yeah.
just trying to get them to
have a bit. And I mean, can you imagine if they threw down their clubs and just went for it on the 13th tee box or something?
I don't remember much of the
player
the
impact
last...
right there.
I don't remember loads about the 2008 US Open. Clearly that was, you know, with the benefit of having watched the Tiger documentary, you know, obviously looking at it in hindsight, you've got, you know, everything that happened there with Tiger's knee, and, you know, that was an incredible event, wasn't it? So, you know, maybe even history will repeat itself and Brooks will come on a charge and, you know, limp his way home.
Yeah. I mean, that is forever going to be remembered as one of the most dramatic US Opens, really, isn't it? For all the circumstances, but also just with the benefit of hindsight, being like, yeah, the guy's going to go 11 years without winning another major. After that, it's just, it is pretty momentous for several reasons. And as you say, I mean, if you get drama on that sort of scale, obviously it has got a pretty dramatic closing hole, potentially, with it being a par five that could be playing pretty firm and fast, but also you're just going to be unable to get to it if you're in the rough. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of picks, I know it's just a fool's errand, isn't it? Really,
to go out there, there. But,
well, I figured, I mean, that's where it's leading naturally, isn't it? You say, oh, let's preview the US Open. We're not just going to talk about the course, are we, and not sort of have a punt on a few players. So who are we all liking this week?
Okay, so there's like a... There's a favorite that out favorites everyone by a country mile, which is if you don't, do you know who it is? No, it's John Rahm, which I mean he was doing well in the Farmers, wasn't he? And he fell off towards the end at the beginning of this year.
Do you guys root for Rahm? Like, you know, how high up does he sort of stack up for you? And if you see him in the mix, how much can you actually root for the guy? I'm curious.
I mean,
the problem with John Rahm is that he just has the... Now, let me caveat this. When he got that COVID thing that happened and then he got... And he got removed from the tournament. You know, his response was classy, you know, the next day, where he was like, you know, it is what it is. Health is more important. The protocol is more important. Good luck to the rest. It was classy. But on the course, he just doesn't seem classy. He seems quite petulant, really. And, you know, he's had a go at his caddy a few times, and he gets quite hot on the collar, and yeah, that's cool. Like, we like it seeing people and their emotions and stuff, but sometimes it's just a bit toys at the pram
it can just border a bit on petulance, kind of, I think. I mean, there's one Twitter user who shall remain nameless, but I've seen him comment on multiple occasions on Rahm and criticize him, and several of those occasions he's just done he's written Rahm, so he's gone like as in R enter A H M, so it's kind of like an acronym or whatever, the layout, and just gone really annoying Hispanic man. That's what he's labeled him as on Twitter, because he finds him that infuriating. And I mean, yeah, like, he can be a bit petulant, Carney, in terms of the club slamming and just the outbursts. And for some reason, it's an interesting point, really, why we find that less acceptable than if someone like Tiger or Kepka is doing it. I don't know why that is, but
I mean,
I know what you mean.
Tiger,
I know.
Well,
he's been a club thrower and a club slammer and effing and blinding and all sorts, but for some reason people tolerate that more than they do with Rahm. I'm not sure why that is. Look, when he's on, he's great to watch, but I know what you mean there, Mills, in terms of he's not the most endearing character to watch on the PGA Tour.
Who's the picks? Come on.
I'm going to go on a limb here. I think he's had an absolutely sterling 2021 so far. You know, he's won in his second PGA Tour start. I think Garrett Higa could just go on an absolute mad one.
Huge. I mean, it is.
What do we think about
Congre, didn't he?
Second PGA Tour start.
You know. Like his wins, like his last five events, are something like 1-1-2, 54-1. You know, it's insane. I
mean, young guy could just go out there with a sort of no fear whatsoever. Go out as an absolute gunslinger, and who knows, maybe he'll bring it home. How do you guys like Phil's chances? Because obviously a lot was made of that immediately after Kiowa. He's playing in his backyard. He's taken a couple of weeks off. He seems like a new Phil Mickelson.
I think if we're having a come down from a cookie jar golf day, I think Phil is still on the epic come down of the Wanamaker. I think it's just too much adrenaline. Yeah. I think it's too much.
You're thinking miscut, too much media pressure. He's just going to bomb out.
I'd be amazed if he makes the cut. I would be amazed if he makes the cut.
I mean, it's such a come down. Like, it's such an epic thing, isn't it? Like, none of us are picking. None of them are picking him for the PGA. To be fair, so if we don't pick him, perhaps he'll go and win it. Let's. Here's the hoping.
Van Rooyen's been playing pretty good golf. I don't know if he's actually in the field or not. His odds are up there. He played. He seemed very frustrated at the PGA. Obviously, friend of the podcast. He played really good golf opening rounds at Congaree from memory. Don't know if there's just a little something there for a big week. I'm looking at something here that's got him at like 300 or 400 to 1. And I just thought he's playing a little bit better than that. Back to Michael Verity, search for where the value's at. Like, the fact is, I can't say anyone at the top of the field. You're sort of thinking, I'm desperate to go after those. Brooks looks like he's absolutely, you know, broken, doesn't he? To be fair, walking up those stairs this afternoon. I mean, I thought someone's going to have to carry him up there.
But he'll still.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm be really psyched to see someone come from nowhere to win it. Like, I don't know why, but I'm just not that amped for the US Open.
Do you know who I'm fancying? Tough course, South African, playing well.
Who stays in?
Bazadenhout.
He's playing well. Again, though, has he got it done? I mean, and I know this is not a great counter pick, but Louis Oosthuizen has won majors. He has won tour events. I get the points you're making. That's the issue with those three South Africans. I guess, I mean, Louis has won. He has won the Open. So that has to count for something. But I just wonder whether you're going to need someone in a US Open if it's getting really, really dicey coming down the stretch. I mean, you make a good point there, Mills, about it would be great to see someone come from behind. It'd be great to see a really exciting day of action on Sunday. I almost feel like the US Open, people can lose it big time on the final day, but no one really comes out and wins it. It's almost just like who screws it up the least on the final day. And if you're kind of in the top three or four groups and you just about manage to nurdle it round and some of the other guys just implode, then that will get it done. No one's going to come out and shoot 62 on the final day unless it's Tommy Fleetwood at Shinnecock Hills. But
that doesn't look like happening, does it now?
No.
With the obvious exception of Bryson last year, that, to be fair, like, obliterated the field in that last.
Went out and won it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was already winning, but he went out and really won it in that last.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Matt Wolf helped him, but yeah, it was, I do hear you. I can't believe we've managed to go a full podcast of picks and not heard about Bob Mack yet. I mean,
no, I just, I feel like I curse him if I mention him. So I'd rather we move on. I mean, I'm surprised we've not heard about Tony Finau yet, but, yeah, do you know what?
He's got a chance, Tony Finau.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Garrick Higo is a pretty solid shout, 95 to 1, isn't it? But, I mean, it all will become clear. It's might be a good tournament. I'm not sure. Maybe a bit of me as a fan would rather watch the Open played at events they don't stage PGA Tour events at.
Yeah, they should sort of shatter the seat, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's like Shinnecock. You're like, okay, I'm really dialed into seeing this because I'm not going to see an event played here, you know, for ages. So, whereas it's like, oh, I've had 6 months since the Farmers and I'll have the Farmers again in 6 months. I'm not quite sure. Now, obviously, they play that over the North and South, but first couple of days, but I don't think that really matters, does it? Let's face it. I mean, the real one I can't wait to see is St. George's next month. That's the one that I think we're all looking forward to.
Yeah, well, hopefully it offers some reasonably compelling viewing this coming weekend.
Well, we're going to be watching it together on Sunday night.
Yeah, we're going to watch the final then. Well, we're not going to promise to pod.
We're not going to lie. Yeah, I was going to say.
Because every time we do
I'm not going in with these comments. No, exactly.
We drive for 7 hours and then watch it and then fall asleep and think, well, that was a fucking waste of time. So we will podcast next week about the US Open. We'll also talk about the course and the trips that we're doing, and we'll do it up there. We're also going to try and hook up with some friends of the pod and maybe record a vodcast or two while we're in Scotland. So eyes and ears peeled and
stay tuned.
Yeah. Stand by your phones.
And hopefully our picks you can steer well clear of, because none of them are going to perform. So
Until next time.
Bye. Adios.
Watch this.